dodges. I ride in this wind.
I predicted in 1990, I said, if we fight a war on drugs in Colombia, the result is going to be more cocaine coming to this country, not less. And within 10 years, the amount of cocaine being grown in Colombia had trebled, which I attribute directly to the fact that planes were flying in and out, putting arms and troops in remote places exactly where the cocaine was being grown. And so out came the cocaine.
It's not my good pony, and you give me your bed.
There have always been these funds coming from abroad, from projects connected to CIA operations, which have corrupted both Congress and the executive. And that's why it's important to recognize we have a deep state in this country.
You're listening to episode 695 of Unwelcome Guests, Lifting the Veil of On the Books Funding. I'm Robin Upton, and we have four speakers this week, with different angles on the black budget of the CIA. Peter Dale Scott, as we've heard, most clearly states that they always had off-the-books funding right from the very start. So to some extent, the whole idea of this congressional approval for what the CIA do and holding the purse strings was right from the get-go a whitewash. Trimmed a few minutes from the start in order to meet the time constraint. As ever, you can download the full audio from this episode's website, unwelcomeguests.net/695. This is from the classic show of US dissident thought, Alternative Views, and it was recorded a quarter century ago.
Today on Alternative Views, we are very happy to have with us Emil D'Antonio, the filmmaker who has made the film on McCarthyism, Point of Order, the film on the Kennedy assassination, Rush to Judgment, the film on the Vietnam War, In the Year of the Pig, the film on Nixon, Milhouse, and many other films. Tomorrow, we're going to interview D'Antonio on his films and plan to produce a series of programs on his work as a filmmaker. Today, however, we want to discuss his political views, in particular, how he views George Bush in relationship to the other right-wing Republican political figures that he spent much of the past decade studying and criticizing.
How would you evaluate him?
I think that when Bush became director of the CIA in 1976, he was charged with one thing, which was to put that show back on the road, to clean it up, to make it tough again, and he did that. And in 1980, when he ran for president, there were over 180 CIA former officers who wore Bush buttons and went all over the country wherever he ran, wherever he was speaking, and supported him into the New Hampshire primary when he finally did blow it. But
were some of these the people who, the worst mad dogs that the Carter administration and Stansfield Turner had kicked out?
That's who they were. They were indeed the mad dogs. The CIA is composed pretty largely of one kind of mad dog or another. I mean, it isn't exactly the Boy Scouts or the Ladies' Village Improvement Society. But I think that Bush has been underestimated throughout. One thing is that he has what might even be called an upper-class demeanor. That softness that many upper-class people affect is frequently misinterpreted as weakness.
Well, he came up through this upper-class network of social clubs and schools and all, so he was right in there with the rest of them in this regard.
I think that he separated himself from a part of his class by going to Andover instead of St. Paul's or St. Mark's or Groton, which are the more social schools. Andover is probably the best United States at that time prep school for men, for boys only. Now it's coeducational. But Andover was a school which emphasized mind and emphasized the ability to deal with books and mathematics, etc. And I don't think Bush was a genius or anything. I don't think he was all that smart, but he was smart enough to do reasonably well at Andover. And it's a very hard school. It still is. It's still the hardest preparatory school in the United States to enter. It's the hardest one to enter. And more of its graduates go on to Harvard and Yale than almost any, than any other prep school in the United States.
So
it's a class. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it's part of a class structure and a class education, and something that leads you to have a mild rather than a loud or aggressive voice. And I think people frequently construe an upper class quiet, moderate voice as weakness, which of course it isn't. You're not a Navy pilot, you don't clean up the CIA, and you don't conduct the rough and even dishonorable campaign that he conducted against Dukakis without being somewhat of a tough guy.
So that Bush is really a serious member of the upper class. He wasn't a playboy, he wasn't frivolous. He was also the son of a senator. Senator Prescott Bush, who had an enormous influence on him and who sort of preceded him along the political path that he later followed. Can we talk a little bit about Bush's family and
Certainly.
His relation to his father?
You know that his grandfather, too, began his own company out in Ohio and was successful. So that Prescott Bush, his father, went to private schools, went to Yale, and the most important thing that happened to Prescott Bush in Yale is the most important thing that happened, say, also to Bill Buckley and to George Bush. Prescott Bush became a member of Skull and Bones. It's impossible to understand what Skull and Bones is and what its thrust is unless you really looked at it pretty hard. It's an extremely secret senior society, which means you were tapped, and you literally are tapped, to join Skull and Bones. You were about 10 members of the senior class are tapped at the beginning of the senior year. Some are official, the editor of the Yale Daily News, the captain of the football team, and then some people who have exhibited leadership qualities, toughness. It's an extremely tight, strange group in which an allegiance is sworn among each other that is far beyond this Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States. It goes beyond family, because your family is left behind in a sense. You go forward with Skull and Bones. It's not an accident that when Bush was vice president, he had a dinner in the White House for about 40 members of Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones is a secret. It's like the original German student societies. The initiations are harsh. Some people think the initiations are homosexual, even, as well as being harsh. But every member of Skull and Bones helps another. And it's a prime loyalty. It's a perfect upper-class construct. And it changes every person who goes through it. Now, Bush's father was in it. Now, Bush's father, there are two kinds of secrecy, I think, in the United States that the average person knows nothing about. One is the secrecy of a major private bank. Now, a private bank isn't like Chase Manhattan Bank. It's not like one of the big Texas banks, which is owned by stockholders and shareholders. A private bank is owned by no women, by a small group of men. The partners sometimes are as few as 15 or 20. And Prescott Bush was a member of Brown Brothers Harriman.
Investment banks.
Investment banks. I was telling Doug earlier that one example of the power of Brown Brothers, back in 1905, the currency of Nicaragua, the 5-centavo note, had on it a picture of a bearded gentleman who was none other than James Brown of Brown Brothers. He wasn't a Nicaraguan. He was the man who loaned money to Nicaragua at usurious rates of interest. And it's the kind of loan that was guaranteed to break the back of any small third world country that did not have an industrial society. And Brown Brothers did this. They were international bankers. Each partner had a private sort of cubicle, and it was a partnership in the purest sense of that word, in that the profits at the end of the year were divided among the partners, and those who were inferior to them were then given bonuses, but the bulk of the money was split. So Prescott Bush was extremely rich, and he lived in a city of great richness, Greenwich, Connecticut. And he trained his children in silence. And this is important when you think of George Bush. And he was a member of Skull and Bones as well. So that when Bush went to Yale and became a member of Skull and Bones, he was well-groomed and well-trained and well-rehearsed in all of that. By the time he was at Yale, his father was a senator. And his father had an extraordinary interest in and function in intelligence affairs. So you have something that's rare in this country, which is a long history in intelligence. I don't mean a long history of intelligence, but in intelligence. And to me, the gravest mistake this country has made in my long life, it's not because I'm against Bush, although I am against Bush, but the gravest mistake this country has made is to elect a former CIA chief president of the United States. I think it's wrong to have the head of the secret police, of the foreign secret police, president of the United States, because he has an oath and a loyalty to the CIA and its many, many criminal acts that transcends his sense of duty or his obligation to the country as a whole and the people as a whole.
Well, this has been indicated by his involvement with the CIA and all of the drug operations in relationship to Central America and South America.
Well, certainly. I mean, Bush was involved in that as vice president. And as president, he's denied it. I don't find that particularly alarming. I mean, this is what one would expect. You could not expect Bush to admit that he was involved in drugs. You can't expect Bush to admit that he was connected with the drugs in Panama when he's just failed in a coup to have Noriega bumped off. Noriega killed his predecessor by putting a bomb in his plane. His predecessor was an interesting man. Graham Greene, the English writer, went there and wrote a book called, I think, A Visit to a Dictator. but he was a benign dictator, and he tried to help the people of his country, Panama. But Noriega put a bomb in his personal airplane, and he blew up in midair. And Noriega took over. And it seems to me that if our country had been reasonable, we would have had a certain reluctance to make a policy of accord with a man who had just murdered his predecessor. Noriega, as you know, is a high-living, big spender who was in drugs from the beginning. And all of our intelligence people knew it. But he was regarded as a stable... We have always looked for stable right-wing dictators in Central and South America. That is our policy. And we reaped what we sowed. We ended up by getting Noriega.
Well, he was also a CIA asset, an intelligence chief, and he was on the payroll of the CIA.
He was on the payroll of the CIA. He worked for the CIA. And under Noriega, something happened of great significance that tends to be omitted, which is there are more banks now in Panama than there are in almost any single country its size in the world. And that includes Liechtenstein. And the banks all had to do with the drug business. And Noriega has a piece of all of those banks. And that could not have happened without the knowledge of George Bush in 1976.
When he was head of the CIA.
When he was head of the CIA.
And yes, he met with him, what, two or three times?
Well, I mean, he denies ever having met with
him.
So let's give him the benefit of the doubt, which I don't really, but let's just for the sake of...
he admits, there's on record...
He's on record that he met twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he denied it anyway. But what you have that's just as important as Bush meeting with him is his chief deputy when he was head of the CIA was a man named Admiral Daniel Murphy, number two person in the CIA, who met with Noriega frequently. And Admiral, in 1982, when Bush was vice president, he was appointed head of the South Florida Drug Task Force. His deputy there was, again, Admiral Daniel Murphy. Uh-huh. Murphy made many trips to Noriega. And that was the time at which you had the real burgeoning of banks. I mean, Panama had no reason to have many banks. The people were poor people. There was a small upper class. And the Americans who were there had their own banks and their own compounds. So that suddenly banks became very popular because all tons and tons of drug money were being emptied. into Panama.
And we're not talking about just mom-and-pop banks. We're talking about...
We're talking about very big deals.
The big New York Wall Street banks.
And the Wall Street and New York banks, of course, are the banks that finally serviced all this money. The money would go into a Panamanian bank, and then it would be wired to New York, and then it would go somewhere else. We saw this in our own country, in Miami. Miami was never particularly noted for banks until the drug system became fully operational. And then, you know, there are all those stories which are true of people going into a bank in Miami with a bushel basket or a paper sack 3 feet high full of $100 bills and say, deposit this. And the bank would charge them immediately 2% for counting it. And 2% of $100,000 is $2,000 for an hour's work. And then instead of paying interest, they would charge them to hold the money. So that the great thing about the drug business is that everybody made out except the poor user of drugs. But the banks made out, the big dealers made out, the little dealers made out. And the sucker on the street who used cocaine and all the rest of it, he didn't do too well.
Dee, it's significant to note that The Nation published an article on the political economy of cocaine. And they indicated that before George Bush took over as drug czar when he was vice president for Reagan, that the federal government was cracking down on these banks, was stopping drug trade by regulating the banks and stopping the flow of drug money. As soon as Bush became drug czar in 1982, they stopped this policy. They went into interdiction. They went into trying to capture boats off of Florida to patrol the border along Mexico. And this just helped the big cocaine cartel that could smuggle in the drugs into this country and that had the wherewithal to do it and then had free banks.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And without that, without the banks, the drug industry would have died because they really needed banks to accept and launder the money. And large, proper U.S. banks did precisely that. It's not an accident, of course, that all that money was then recycled in one form or another to go back and help the Contras.
Well, this is the other link here, the reason the Reagan administration and Bush were so tolerant to big drug dealers and people like Noriega, who were obviously involved in drug trafficking, but were also helping them with an illegal supply operation to the Contras. This seemed to be the obsession of the Reagan administration that Bush went along with completely.
We saw an article, I forget which was, one in Playboy or some others, series of articles, where they said that in order to get Noriega to play ball with him and to give Noriega protection and immunity from being hassled and arrested, perhaps, or assassinated, he had to agree to give a certain percentage, 2 or 3%, whatever, off the top of his gross receipts to support the
Contras.
So that's one of the reasons that Noriega said, I've got Bush by the balls. I thought it was so funny all during this business of the failed coup in Panama where they said, gosh, why didn't George Bush just go in there and get Noriega and bring him out and put him on trial? You know, this is terrible. That's the last thing George Bush wants to do is to put Noriega on trial.
But the mistaken putsch, on the other hand, is almost as bad as a trial in the sense that Noriega has a hold on this country and on this administration. And it's got to be deposited in a Swiss bank somewhere, plus in his own mind and tongue. And he has the capacity to blackmail a fair number of major U.S. players, including, I would suspect, the president of this country. For sure, Daniel Murphy and many others. To me, one of the most pathetic things, one of the most pathetic events in our time, of recent time, were the Kerry hearings, which was the most exciting and dramatic hearing I've seen on television since Watergate or since the Army-McCarthy hearings. And it was relegated to a cable channel. It was relegated to CNN.
Or C-SPAN.
C-SPAN.
Right.
And which is a very, a channel most people do not watch, and you can't watch it unless you have cable. And these hearings went on. The outcome is published in 4 volumes, which you can buy from the U.S. government printing office. But to see these young Americans on camera, to see a young Cuban on camera who's saying, well, I was in my Learjet at takeoff. Kerry said, how much money do you have with you? He said, oh, I don't know, 5.4 mil. I was on my way down to Panama, and the police arrested me, and they took my money, and I've been given 30 years, and that's why I'm talking, hoping to get a smaller sentence. And then to see an American, a young, a good-looking American guy, maybe 24, 25, say, I started running a little boat down to Central America, and maybe into Colombia, and I'd get marijuana. And I made $30,000 on one trip. Then I got a bigger boat, and I made $500,000. And then I realized that marijuana really wasn't the right drug to bring in anyway. So I bought an airplane, and I learned how to fly it. I used to fly into Colombia, and I would bring in... And these people were flying right into the U.S., one after the other. These people were finally arrested, but all of them had 1, 2, 3 years' experience. One person who was arrested was a transplanted Cuban who worked out of the Bahamas. Absolutely. There's a whole chapter on the Bahamas.
This is
Bahamas was considered the great drug import center for the whole United States, for the entire United States. And one of these people said, well, you know, I used motorboats, small, fast motorboats, go from the Bahamas right into Miami. And he said, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, there are 50,000 boats out there. The family dentist and everybody else has a boat. So I have 10 boats filled with drugs. So if one of my guys got busted, well, I could buy them out after a few months and pay them well. But 9 would get through. So now Bush and company are worried about the drug problem. They were part of the drug problem.
Right.
They were in the drug business. The CIA was in the drug business. The very heart of the CIA was to say drugs for money, for guns. And the guns was to support the Contras against the legitimate government of Nicaragua. And this has been going on a long time. There's no greater disease in American life than the madness of anti-communism. Because Nicaragua was never a threat to the United States.
It was never communist either.
And it was never truly communist. If you think that Cuba is communist, Cuba, how could Cuba be a threat to the United States? Our radar is so good that if a plane took off and came close, we'd blow it out of the sky. Do they have the troops to invade us? The answer is no. The United States has also not understood, I think, a fundamental question about most of these countries, which is that they're nationalist more than they are communist or Marxist. They're nationalist in that the United States, Fidel Castro is the first person to rule Cuba in modern times, modern history, going back 300 years, who was a Cuban. First you had the Spanish, and then you had the Americans, and then you had Fidel. Even if you hate Fidel, and I don't, but even if you do, you have to admit he's the first Cuban. And the same thing is true in Nicaragua. We bought all those other people in Nicaragua, one president after another. We armed them. We gave them great money, personal wealth. And Ortega is the first ruler of Nicaragua who is truly a Nicaraguan and not somebody in the pay of the United States. And he's not in the pay of the Soviet Union, which can't afford to pay anybody very much. He's I would call Ortega a patriot, as I would call most of his enemies, people who represented a bankrupt class which exploited the rest of the people. I'm making too many speeches.
Well, you have so many interesting topics to discuss. What I thought we might do now is to go back and look into the roots of George Bush's involvement in the intelligence community. You made an interesting point that Bush's father and Bush were members of Skull and Bones. That was a secret society that was dedicated to secrecy, secret bonds, oaths, and that Bush's training in his family trained him that secrecy was of primary value.
And the banking business.
And the banking business is another secret organization that his father participated in. At one time, you had an idea that when Bush was involved in Texas oil business, he might have had intelligence connections and involvements. And indeed, his beginning in the Texas oil business, after he returned home from World War II, had some connections with Skull and Bones. Do you want to elaborate on this?
Yeah.
These connections?
I'd like to go back one
okay,
step.
Sure.
Bush's father was an officer in the First World War, the 1914 to 1918 war. And part of his training took place at Fort Sill, Indiana, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where two of his closest skull and bone friends went with him as young officers. One of them, a key person in George Bush's life, was Neil Mallon. By the way, both Prescott Bush and Neil Mallon not only served in the field artillery, but also in intelligence in World War I. So you have a hereditary connection to intelligence. When they came out, Mallon went to Texas, and with very little money, he bought a piece of a semi-bankrupt company that he formed and became one of the big corporations in Texas, Dresser Industries.
Oh, yeah.
Now, George Bush, having been a pilot and entered Yale, then having been enlisted as a pilot at age 18, after having been shot down and then returning to Yale and taking his degree, decided that he and his wife and young child would drive to Texas in their floppy old car, and they did. And they sought out Neil Mallon. And Neil Mallon gave George Bush a job in Dresser Industries. And Bush says in his campaign autobiography, and Mallon also confirms it, that the job was essentially, the first job was sort of sweeping the place to learn something about the business and then going up. And then Bush decided to become an oil player here in Texas. And he, with Mallon's help, he did. And it's no accident that when his next child was born, the child was named Neil Mallon Bush. Now, it is my unprovable conclusion, because you can't prove much about the activity of intelligence people. The whole gambit is to keep it secret. I think that Mallon, who had been in intelligence in World War I, carried on a kind of freelance intelligence after World War I, and as he built up Dresser Industries into being quite an enormous corporation. And I think, and I may be alone in the whole United States in this, I think that George Bush acquired, sometime in the early 1950s through Neil Mallon, a connection with the CIA. The CIA is something about which we know nothing. It was constructed that way, it's meant to be that way, and it's not very easy. You cannot get anything from the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI is bad enough. I applied to both the CIA and the FBI for any files they might have held on me. The FBI at least gave me, you know, quite a few thousand pages, but the CIA would give me many pages in which everything was blacked out but my name, something I was quite familiar with, so that you know, there it was. The CIA never yielded anything, and to this day, it has never yielded anything under the Freedom of Information Act. And to this day, its primary concern is secrecy. So you can't ever prove. I could be just a liar and make this up about Bush, and they would not deny it. And I could even prove it, maybe, and they would not deny it. They would have no comment. Because the CIA is not stupid. It's clever enough to know that denial constitutes a form of acceptance, of agreement. So they have no answer to give. And if you were to write for the files of George Bush and the CIA in the 1950s, they would respond with, there is no answer.
But we do know something, that in the 1950s, with the help of Neil Mallon, George Bush founded the Zapata Oil Corporation. We know that that had corporate headquarters in Texas and was very active all around the Caribbean, precisely the place that the CIA was interested in at that time. We also know in 1963, after the Kennedy assassination, a memo turned up from J. Edgar Hoover to George Bush asking him about the results of his survey of the community, the Cuban exile community, and how they were responding to the Kennedy assassination. So there's a piece, some evidence at least, circumstantial and actual, that links Bush to the intelligence community during that period when he was an oil man in Texas.
We also know that the CIA for many years has used various organizations, corporations, multinational corporations, as either fronts,
right,
or just as a source of information and cooperation. So it's not surprising.
True. It's not a bureaucratic distinction, but those corporations are regarded as assets. whereas it's my contention that Bush was an officer. And in the CIA language, there's an enormous difference.
Right. Yes.
I mean, an asset could be any flag-waving businessman who, you're going to Germany, you're going to open a business there. We'd be interested if you'd report along these lines, you know, and then there'd be certain specific things. They were not, but as an officer, you would go in there with the capability to hire other people to perform acts, even violent acts, to suborn other people, to bribe them, to conduct the kind of policy that, let's face it, that all intelligence groups, whether they be the U.S. or British or Soviet or Chinese or Cuban, do. This is what intelligence groups do. They hire people to commit acts of sabotage. It was somebody Bush knew who put a bomb into a Cuban airplane and killed 53 people. It was somebody who was probably a vague asset of the CIA. And Bush's connections, as you quite rightly pointed out, with the Caribbean, became a major point of interest for the United States, because after all, Cuba is over there on that other side. As I say, this all seems like something conjectural. You can't prove. You can never prove that a spy is a spy until you put him before a firing squad and he's willing to speak it. But even most spies of quality prefer to die rather than to say anything. This is the history that the British established long before we had any spies.
See, let's move towards George Bush's entry into politics. He was the son of Prescott Bush, who was the senator of Connecticut, who became a quite powerful senator. His father also went to Yale, as did Bush. His father was also in Skull and Bones and the Whippenpoo Society, as was Bush. His father also played first base for Yale, as was Bush. Did Bush. His father had intelligence connections in World War One, as we are suggesting Bush did. So there was obviously a big influence of the father on the son. George followed Prescott's footsteps pretty closely. Moreover, George decided to run for politics, possibly as a CIA asset or operative moving into the political field. What is your theories about these connections?
Well, he started running for office in Texas, be as candid as we can, from an oil district.
Right.
And he failed.
Right.
After failing, he was elected to Congress, but then he wanted to be elected to the Senate, and he was defeated by Yarborough, who was a liberal Texan. Then down the road, it looked as if Yarborough's reputation was turning sour among the people of Texas, and Bush decided to run against him. But then out of the blue appeared our friend who ran for the vice presidency with Dukakis.
Lloyd Benson,
right. And who ran against Yarborough, so that Bush, having spent a fortune thinking he was going to beat Yarborough, I mean, Yarborough would take the Democratic nomination, and instead, Benson, of course, beat Yarborough in the Democratic primary.
With a vicious red-baiting campaign.
Yeah. And then you had the tightest race in the history of Texas, which was Benson against Bush, and each one of them spending more money than anybody had ever spent to run for the Senate, and Bush lost by a tiny, tiny number of votes.
Oh,
it was the closest race ever held for the Senate in the state of Texas.
And Benson said Bush was too liberal.
Benson was running as a true conservative. At this point, Nixon decided to help young Bush out, and he appointed him
ambassador to the UN.
Ambassador. He gave him two appointments. Mm-hmm. First, ambassador to the United Nations.
Right.
And Bush wasn't very comfortable with that. He didn't like being in New York, among other things. Then he became ambassador to China. And then he had the job that was really quite interesting. He became chair of the Republican National Committee. And he was in that job when Watergate broke out. And there are two famous letters that George Bush wrote to Nixon. One is, no matter how this comes out, I will back you to the end. And the second one is, it really grieves me to write such a letter, but I would think you would do more of a service to your country and to your party if you resigned. And so Bush flip-flopped on that. And, of course, Nixon left. And shortly after that, Ford or a year and a half after that, Ford appointed Bush then to become head of the CIA.
Right.
Which was a curious appointment. The CIA people wanted somebody strong who must have had some experience with the CIA. Otherwise, you would have to believe that the CIA, which was really under tremendous problems because of post-Vietnam activity, there were investigations of the Phoenix program. As you know, the Phoenix program permitted one CIA person and one Vietnamese to say that you were a Viet Cong and they could blow you away and had the right to kill you. It was the right to kill people. We admitted that we killed about 25,000 people in the Phoenix program. The Vietnamese claim it was closer to 400,000, and nobody will know what the answer is. And I suspect myself that it was probably somewhere in between, and I'm not a liberal. Bush was then well ensconced into the heart of the National Republican Party, and he obviously eyed the presidency. In the beginning, he was a favorite to beat Reagan in 1980.
Well, it's also significant that Bush was the candidate of the top people of the American power structure, David Rockefeller and all of those groups.
And a tremendous number of CIA people.
Mm-hmm. And he had been in the Trilateral Commission, and he had all these upper-class connections. And Reagan was just this rank outsider, the crazy man from the right. And so that when Reagan won, the establishment folks freaked out and then tried to come up with this special arrangement where they would have Kissinger really running the country and Bush up there as the head man really doing things behind the scene. And Reagan balked at that, so they finally came up with a compromise where Bush would be vice president. And Bush turned out to be the real heavy in the White House running all of these covert operations and keeping
them
going.
Let's talk about that. I mean, Bush was a very heavy player in the Reagan administration. What are some of the things that he was doing?
There is nothing that took place in Central America that Bush was not involved in. And Central America is really the primary emphasis in that period. It's not only the Contras, it was anti-Cuban stuff, it was our war supporting the government of El Salvador. It was essentially South America. And Bush had access to all the CIA people. It was like the head of the CIA was suddenly planted in the White House. He had Donald Gregg, there's nobody sort of wilder in the history of the CIA who was reporting to the White House and Bush than a guy named Rodriguez.
Felix Rodriguez,
as opposed to Chi-Chi and the others. But Felix Rodriguez invented a new kind of way to kill people in Vietnam. It took a lot of courage. Rodriguez had a lot of guts, and he did the most dangerous work you can think of, and he did it well, and it's too bad that it was probably the most immoral idea anybody ever had, but it still took courage. I mean, life is a contradictory idea, and it would be great if all the villains were cowards, but they aren't. And Rodriguez was a hero in the wrong cause, but what he would do was fly a very light airplane, and he would find VC, as they called it, National Liberation Front positions, and he would hang in long enough to call in the bombers who would then come in and bomb those positions and kill the people. And he did the same thing in Central America. He went to the White House. He was a close friend of Donald Gregg's, who was Bush's closest friend, the man who just this year was made ambassador to Korea with a lot of struggle and a lot of Donald Gregg. I mean, the Democrats in the Senate have never been known for courage, because they should have blocked that nomination.
Oh, boy.
I mean, Gregg was no more fit to be an ambassador than I am. And I was a communist when I was 16 years old, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But
I think the key event here is that it was alleged, at least in the Rolling Stone magazine, that George Bush was put in charge of this Black Eagle operation.
Yep.
That was an illegal supply operation to the Contras to get them arms that would circumvent the scrutiny of Congress, and that he brought in at that time Donald Gregg to run this Central America Contra supply operation. Gregg, in turn, hired Felix Rodriguez, his old buddy from Vietnam. So you had a CIA military operation being run out of George Bush's office. When Eugene Hassenfuss's plane was shot down, who was part of this supply operation in October of 1986, he had in his notebook Don Gregg's telephone number, Felix Rodriguez, and the first person that was called when that Felix Rodriguez called when the plane was shot down was Don Gregg. And I guess Sam Watson, who was his assistant, took the phone call.
Colonel Watson, right?
Yeah, so that Bush's office was heavily involved in this illegal Contra supply operation. It was the same drug operation, the same operation that we talked about earlier with Noriega that was running illegal drugs.
Well, it was the only way to get money to buy the arms that would support our right-wing forces in Nicaragua.
Right.
I mean, it put the White House itself in the drug business.
The arms would go down, but then the drugs would come back.
This is
in the same plane.
The most astounding single tale in the Kerry Commission is this one pilot who said, now, where do you want me? He brought down the arms, and he had a whole DC-4, a four-engine plane. He said, where do you want me to land? And they said, Homestead Air Force Base. Well, the idea of a pilot landing at Homestead in Florida, which is a United States Air Force Base, when he landed, there was no problem. He told the tower he was coming in, and to me, almost the greatest cinematic thing there is I used to be a pilot, and when you land, there's a truck there with a big sign lit up that says, follow me. So there was the Jeep. It was not a truck. There was the Jeep saying, follow me. And it took him into a hard stand, and he parked his plane full of drugs and left, which would lead one to assume that somebody connected with the Air Force or else a private contractor came and emptied, unloaded, what would probably be several tons of drugs, enough to keep the streets of New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and Houston going for a long time.
Not to mention Wall Street.
Wall Street and Beverly Hills and the movie industry
right.
And the rich and all the users of high-grade cocaine.
And the irony of this is, at the same time, Bush is named drug czar of the Reagan administration.
He was.
So at the same time that his Central America operation is smuggling drugs into this country in unprecedented numbers, he's supposed to be in charge of the war on drugs that the Reagan administration and later Bush has exploited for political ends.
He was truly a drug czar,
right?
So.
Well, now the Oliver North operation was going on parallel to this, but then George Bush would have to step in and cool things when Oliver North was having trouble with Donald Gregg and Felix Rodriguez.
Well, you know, the right wing of our country always uses the word conspiracy about those who disagree with it. But if there was ever a first-rate conspiracy, a massive conspiracy in the history of our country, it was in the White House. We now know that Reagan had some idea of what was going on, but Reagan was not a hands-on president. He couldn't even remember the names of his Secretary of State or high officials.
Yeah.
So that he wasn't totally connected with this, but he was made aware of it. But there it was in the White House under George Bush and Donald Gregg and other senior officers of the State Department and the CIA. We are now talking about drugs in the streets and people dying and ODing, and we have a drug culture beyond measure. But you can't say it began in the White House, but it certainly was very big in the White House. It was the White House that made it possible. Had the Reagan administration really said, this is the end, we're going to close it down, it could have been closed down. I no longer think it can be closed down because there are just too many people involved. I was in Los Angeles at the home of a person I cannot mention. He's a major player in the film industry. And in his house, he has 8 or 10 collector's items of 18th century English silver. And each one of them is filled with the most expensive cocaine you can buy. And it's there for the guests to take and snuff. And the use of cocaine is standard among all classes of people in this country. The poor die from it because they get inferior cocaine. They get, in some cases, cocaine that's been mixed with poison, either intentionally or by mistake. And the rich get very pure, first-class cocaine. I don't think there's even anybody among the young people in this room who doesn't know somebody who hasn't used cocaine. And you can't say that Bush is responsible for it. I mean, that's too much. You can only say that Bush shares a very profound responsibility. And it's time that he turned his back on that responsibility. So, I mean, it may be too late to stop it, but it's not too late to make an effort.
It's absurd that now, as President of the United States, Bush declares another war,
the war on drugs,
because he was so responsible for having connections with so many players in the drug world when he was Reagan's vice president.
Of course, it gives them a good opportunity to do away with a lot of civil liberties and do away, hopefully, with a lot of opposition.
Exploiting
absolutely,
the drug issue.
How would you evaluate the mass media coverage of all this that we've been talking about?
Cowardly. Cowardly, basically.
Why do you think that is? Here, an enormous story, far bigger than Watergate ever was, and yet they hushed it up.
Well, I think the main reason for that is class interest, frankly. And they're the people who put Bush in, the media people. They're the people who supported Bush and who supported Reagan. And in a sense, it's to admit their own culpability in a reflexive, secondary way, but nonetheless a kind of culpability. And it's to admit error, which the press and the media no longer admit error. TV has gone soft. The great gray papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post, they don't deal with this.
The Times would have an occasional page 10 story about the Contras and drugs where they said the sources were merely convicted drug dealers, as if the story really didn't have all that much credence to it. And they never connected Bush with all this.
Well, to me, I go back to the Kerry Commission, Kerry Committee. The Kerry Committee report is as good a report on drugs as will be made by this government. And it's a first-class report. It covers everything. It covers the Bahamians. It covers all of Central America. It covers Colombia. It covers Americans. It covers all kinds of people who have flown back and forth. It covers pilots and big-time distributors, people who owned many, many planes, etc. And nobody picked up on this. As I said, it was broadcast on C-SPAN. It would appear as a small story in the New York Times and the Washington Post. But the basic thrust of what Kerry uncovered is still there. And it was published by the obviously by the government printing office in a small printing, and very few people bought it. You can still pick up the phone now and order the four volumes, and they are staggering. You have enough there to bring down a government. And Kerry himself seems to have lost his courage, and he's a very brave man, Kerry, but he seems to have lost something. I mean, I know one of the reasons, and you hate to say this in public, so I won't. Well, since you laugh, I will. I mean, his wife and children left him, I mean, because he was having an affair with a major Hollywood star, Michelle Pfeiffer. And it took away some of his efficiency. But Kerry was remarkable. He was the most decorated naval officer in the Vietnam War. And the first thing he did when he came back home was join Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Right.
And that's a remarkable position. I mean, you know, it takes courage to fight in a war, but it takes more courage to come back and do that. And then to have the skill to be elected to the Senate in the state of Massachusetts was an extraordinary achievement. And to do the hearings was an extraordinary achievement. And to let them drop makes you wonder, you know, is he being, people see him as a new Jack Kennedy, people see him as a presidential candidate.
See, the media completely ignored him, so to pursue this to the maximum, he might have been bumping his head against the wall because he wasn't getting any response. The media completely covered this up.
Well, I want to know what was wrong with America.
Mm-hmm.
It was that his show going on, not C-SPAN, but C-SPAN,
right,
seen by the smallest possible audience, that the other media, ABC, NBC, CBS, never picked up on.
Right.
They would have the slightest reference to it. And it was as big as the Army-McCarthy hearings. It was as big as Watergate. And when people say the war on drugs, et cetera, this is the greatest menace to the, it strikes at the very heart of this country. I mean, this is only 2 years ago. Why didn't somebody just, even today, why doesn't George Bush, if he believes in the war on drugs, pick up the Kerry Commission report, committee report, and send it out to the American people? Why aren't 5 million copies distributed?
Well, they'd have to cut the Contras off. They'd have to close the Contras.
They'd have to cut Daniel Murphy off.
And these are Bush's pets. Bush has been deeply involved in his Contra operation.
It's the greatest reading. It's the funniest reading. There's a 500-pound arms dealer in Miami, an Armenian guy. He weighs 500 pounds. He has a huge palace on the grounds of the Miami International Airport. when Daniel Murphy wanted to borrow a plane to go to see Noriega, he goes to see the arms dealer. And the arms dealer says to him, and both of them testify to this in the Kerry Commission. Murphy has no qualms about testifying. The arms dealer says to him, well, last time I loaned you the plane. This time I can lend it to you, but you've got to pay for the gas. Well, you know, it's a four-engine plane, so the gas is $4,000 or $5,000. So Murphy takes it down to Panama, sees Noriega, and he's got a business guy with him, and then they fly back. Now, could this have nothing? Of course, Murphy was number two in the South Florida Drug Task Force under George Bush. This is 1982. How could he do that, you know? You'd think that some reporter somewhere would write an article about it. Nobody said anything. The Panamanian said nothing. We said nothing. And the more we talk about a free press, they're free to advertise. They're free to sell. But they don't print like a free press. They don't publish like a free press. And you could say to me, well, if you don't like this country, why don't you go somewhere else? Well, this is my country. And I love this country. I may despise its government. I may despise the CIA and the FBI. But this is my country. I wish somebody had said at that moment, this is time to do something about the drug world, starting with Daniel Murphy, maybe with George Bush, surely with the arms dealer, and surely with the guy who flew the airplane.
And the Contras.
And the Contras, and all the rest of the, and the CIA, right, and all the rest right. of that wretched machinery.
How different the world might be now if people had recognized the truth of Emile D'Antonio's words at the time. And now some audio about a repressed truth of the modern era. This is from the March 2011 Investigate Building 7 conference, a panel discussion of the failure of the commercially controlled, or should I say, the deep state controlled media to report on the topic. We've heard Mark Crispin Miller's contribution back in episode 561. We're going to hear from Dick Russell in just a minute, but first, Craig Unger talking about the October surprise.
Well, I came to the story in 1991, and it was really a very famous op-ed piece in the New York Times by Gary Sick, who now teaches at Columbia University and runs the Middle East Studies programs there. And Gary, who I've come to know and admire, was on the National Security Council under Jimmy Carter. He had previously been on the National Security Council in Republican administrations. He's sort of the opposite of an ideologue. He's a scholarly. He's really a scholar more than anything. And he had been in the Carter White House in 1979 when Iran seized 52 American hostages. And he was there as Carter tried to negotiate with Iran. He is an Iran specialist and has been for, I think, 40 years or so. And he did not believe the initial charges at all, and it was many years later he began to put them together. It was not until 1991, in other words, 12 years later, that he wrote this article in the New York Times that put forth the theory, for want of a better term, that there had been secret negotiations between the Reagan-Bush campaign, led by William Casey, who later became head of the CIA, and had secret meetings and actually delivered arms. These are private citizens. They're not in the U.S. government, to Iran, then a hostile foreign power, making a deal effectively saying, don't return the hostages until after the election. If you return them before, Carter will win. If you return them after, we will arm you for your war with Iran.
Iraq.
This was what he argued in his op-ed piece, and I began to investigate it, and I did an 8,000-word piece for Esquire magazine, and then the shit hit the fan. And Newsweek actually hired me for a while to lead their investigation, but I was on the story. My friend and colleague Bob Perry was on it and did it for PBS Frontline. He did 2-hour-long documentaries. It's a piece with 10,000 puzzles, and not every question was answered, but many, many, many were. And a picture began to emerge. And what was interesting was the way the story began to be sabotaged. And you would see sources emerge who would go to various reporters, and they would give them exclusive information to a real story, and the story would turn out to be true, and it would make headlines, and the reporter would get real excited. And then he'd get another story, and it would be true, and suddenly he was in the national limelight. And then the third story would come, and suddenly it exploded in his face. And this happened to four or five reporters that I knew of, and you saw it began to be happen that in other words, sources went out delivering disinformation and thereby discrediting reporters who were investigating, and they saw their career go up in tatters. You also saw certain reporters began attacking those of us who were doing this investigating. There was, I think I was the subject of at least six different attacks. Now, I'm not worthy of that many stories. I'm simply not. One reporter doesn't do six stories on me. That's unusual. I know a good story. I'm not that good. And you saw this happen again and again until the story was completely marginalized. There were books on it. There was a congressional investigation that I don't think got to the bottom of it. I began to see that bipartisan commissions, it doesn't mean they're getting the truth. It means they're agreeing on a political reality often more than actually getting to the bottom of things. I also could see, and I've had happier outcomes in various stories. For example, when I did House of Bush, House of Saud, which came to me immediate the day of 9/11, I said, wait a minute, these are Saudis. The Bushes are very close to the Saudis. What's up with that? And I started Googling, and within hours, I got to the company called the Carlyle Group, and I was Googling Bush, Saudi, and I came to this large private equity firm. I don't think I'd even heard of it, called the Carlyle Group. It turned out the chief partners in that were the elder George Bush, the younger George Bush, James Baker, several members of what I began to call the House of Bush, a lot of members of the Royal House of Saud, and a family called the Bin Laden family. And I said, gee, that's very interesting. What does that mean? And I went back the next day to the website. Fortunately, I saved some of it to my hard disk, but I went back the next day to their website, and it had been scrubbed. Fortunately, there's something on the internet called the Wayback Machine, and it's very hard to scrub your website, even for the Carlyle Group. So I could continue doing research, and House of Bush, House of Saud grew out of that. But when I began shopping the story around, remember, at that time, Bush was the most popular president in the history of the United States. I went to six or seven publications, all of which rejected the idea out of hand, and finally Vanity Fair, and to his credit, Graydon Carter is one of the few people who was open to doing stuff that was critical of Bush fairly early on, and that's how the story got launched. But by the time the book came out 2 years later, the tide had turned, and you could tell people were hungry for that information.
I guess it's worth noting that our mutual friend Robert Parry has doggedly stuck with the story of the October surprise and has demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that all the alibis that were used to make the case that Bill Casey couldn't have been meeting with the Iranians, all that evidence is been devastated. And yet still, you ask any person who doesn't think too much about these things about that story, and it gets dismissed as a conspiracy theory. Dick, maybe you could tell us about your work back in the 70s when, briefly, the window opened and a certain amount of truth was circulating. You know, there were congressional investigations of the CIA. This is in the wake of Watergate. And the left press actually did do a great deal of serious investigative reporting.
Yeah, they did. The Village Voice in particular, I started writing for in 1975. I was living in New York. And the Voice was very open to covering the Kennedy assassination, the King assassination. There were new investigations going on in the House and the Senate at that time. And I think I did a dozen cover stories or something for the Voice. And the curious thing was that the national media, the bigger media, were totally obfuscating or ignoring what had really happened to Kennedy, even though the House committee was about to come out with a report that said that there was a conspiracy. And that report, by the way, that story, when that report came out, was buried on page 39 of the New York Times alongside the obituary column, I believe, or the classified ads. But I wanted to sort of run through a history of what the media did not do, and then a little bit of why back then, and which leads us up to today.